From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The face of California's workforce differs in fundamental ways from previous generations. The Great Recession only accelerated these changes. Are different state policies needed to better support business while advancing the economic security of workers? We'll ask. Luke Riedenbach, policy analyst with the California Budget and Policy Center, a nonpartisan organization that focuses on evaluating the impact of public policies on low- and middle-income Californians. We'll also hear from Tom Scott, executive director of the National Federation of Independent Business, California, an association representing small and independent businesses. Employment conditions post-recession, same as it ever was?
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive from the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute. It's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
So what is the post-recession jobs report? Have we finally made it all the way back, or do we still have a ways to go? Our guest is Luke Riedenbach, a policy analyst with the California Budget and Policy Center. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So has California regained the number of jobs lost as a result of the Great Recession?
Yeah, it has. We are now 700,000 jobs more in California than we were before the Great Recession began. Since the recovery started in early 2010, the state has added more than 2 million jobs. And what's even better is that the state is growing at a pace that is much higher than the national average. So California's labor market is actually doing quite well. That said, workers are still facing a number of challenges throughout the state, especially in some regions, like here in the Central Valley. Unemployment remains very high in some regions. In fact, 1 in 10 workers are out of work.
That's historically been a problem in the Valley, right? A high unemployment. But let me ask you this. Normally, when you come out of a recession, they get out of a recession typically, I think the average you said is 31 months in your report. It wasn't that way this time. This time it was like 60, or two-thirds more, like 60, I'm sorry, 50 months, I think you said, in your report. So why did it take so much longer to get out of the recession this time than in previous recessions?
We like to describe the current jobs recovery as typical job growth following a one-of-a-kind economic downturn. The rate of job growth, the pace of recovery is actually pretty similar to what we've seen in previous economic recoveries. The problem is that it's following an absolutely devastating economic recession. Right? We lost somewhere around 1.4 million jobs in just a few years. So it's really not about the pace of recovery. It's about what we're following.
Well, one of the things also was interesting in your report that I read was the public sector and the impact of the public sector on bringing those jobs back.
Yeah.
A lot of jobs were cut in the public sector as local communities had to cut back because they didn't have the tax revenues.
And a lot of those jobs haven't returned. The local government sector really has struggled to find its footing. And some analysts have actually observed that maybe those jobs are gone for good, that maybe the local government sector cut to the bone and then is figuring out efficiencies in other areas. But the local government sector has usually been a source of job growth and has actually sort of helped offset devastating losses, and that just hasn't happened this time.
Yeah. What about the long-term unemployed? Has their situation gotten better or worse?
Their situation has gotten better. And in fact, in this recession, one of the most defining problems was this issue of long-term unemployment. Millions of people were unemployed, and a significant share of those were unemployed for long periods of time. We're talking about 6 months, a year. And at one point, there was over 1 million people in California who were unemployed for 6 months or longer. And that's actually down to around 400,000. So we've seen a lot of progress. The question for us is actually what's happened to those people, right? The longer that you are unemployed, the more likely you are to drop out of the labor force entirely, go to early retirement. You're not even counted in the numbers, right? You kind of disappear. And even for those who do get jobs, they often take jobs that pay less than their earlier jobs. And so there really is a lot of questions about what's happened to those workers and how they're doing now. And that, to me, is is a more interesting question to answer, and we're hoping to find answers to that soon.
You know, this is what's kind of devastating is particularly you see the older workers, you know, lose a job, and how difficult it is to get back into the labor market after you've lost a high-paying job as an executive or something. Well, let's talk about the wages of California workers. How were California workers doing before the Great Recession?
Not that great if it comes to wages. You know, even before the recession started, low and mid-wage workers were enduring pretty much decades of stagnating wages. And what that means is that the wages they were earning were not keeping up with the overall cost of living.
So their purchasing power basically is flat.
Yeah, it's flat. And
anybody doing well?
High-wage earners, right? And so this is there's actually been sort of this widening wage inequality where high-wage earners have seen their wages outpace the cost of living, so the purchasing power of their wages are going up. But for low and mid-wage workers, they're either stagnating or eroding. And this has happened even before the recession began, and it actually worsened during the recession.
What about low-income households? You said in your report that they actually increased 12.3% from 1979 to 2007. How does that happen?
So that is one of the more interesting takeaways from these trends is that annual earnings are going up, but hourly earnings are going down. And one of the reasons for that is that people are simply working longer. Right, that much of this increase in annual earnings is simply because people making up for the declining purchasing power of their wages, they're just working more. And while their standard of living may have gone up because their annual income is going up, that's undermined by the fact that they have to put in a lot more hours to get there.
Okay, and so what did the Great Recession do to the earnings then of low and middle income workers?
So during the recession, kind of get out of econ land for a minute, right? And just, you know, during the recession, what happens is that there's so many workers that are unemployed. Everybody's competing for the same jobs, and employers don't really feel compelled to lift wages, right? Because they can get the same employees for essentially less. And what happens is as the cost of living goes up, the purchasing power of the wages that people have who are employed erode. And that happened to not just low and mid-wage workers, but high-wage workers as well. Okay. But since the recovery started, only really high-wage workers have seen their wages go up.
Okay. Well, thanks for that post-recession jobs report.
Yeah.
Up next, has the California workforce changed in the aftermath of the Great Recession? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. So what does the California workforce look like? We're talking to Luke Reidenbach, a policy analyst with the California Budget and Policy Center. So can you describe the face of the California workforce? How is it changing?
Yeah, so over the last three decades that we looked at, California's workforce has become increasingly diverse. You know, 1984, 1 in 3 workers were workers of color. Now that's far more than half of California workers are workers of color. And a good third are Latino. And so what we were looking at is how that workforce has changed and whether workers of color face any specific challenges.
Yeah, do they?
Yeah, so workers of color tend to have some much more volatile experiences in the labor market. They're more likely to see their wages decline or erode, and they're more likely to face unemployment, both in good times and bad. And so from our perspective, if you want to increase employment outcomes for California workers as a whole, you actually have to focus on the specific challenges that workers of color face in the labor market.
Is that because of educational levels or something like that? What's driving that?
Some of it is education levels, training, it's access to good jobs or the types of jobs that workers of color or in communities of color can get. There are other factors as well. There is sort of known biases in hiring that kind of happen at all levels. You do have sort of mass incarceration that actually has disproportionately affected communities of color, and that has an impact on their employment prospects once somebody leaves the system. So all these factors are working together, and there are many more. I mean, it's an extraordinarily overwhelming and complicated problem, right? But the fact is that we have to do something about the challenges that workers of color face.
Yeah, what about women? Their role in the workforce is obviously expanding. What are some of the unique market challenges that women face?
So women face a number of problems in the workforce, and this is even after making significant gains over the last 50 years. It's hard to actually overstate the economic importance of women entering the workforce. They've been one of the biggest drivers of the increase in household incomes. But at the same time, they're often paid less for similar work, and this is something that recent legislation signed by Governor Brown is going to try to address. They're underrepresented in management and CEO positions, and also the rise of women in the workforce has sort of corresponded with this other challenge of families having a hard time balancing the needs of work and family, right? The share of households where all parents are working has gone up to more than half, close to 60% for families with children. Right? So now families are having to figure out how to afford childcare, how to balance some very practical, you know, work-life considerations.
Any parent would know that.
And this is not something that's really brought up in sort of the field of economics, but it really actually ends up being an economic issue because you have to think about how to make it easier for families to work,
right?
And how to be a full-time worker.
And that's childcare policies and things of that nature, leave policies.
Exactly.
Let me transition to, we talked earlier about education levels. How is California doing in terms of educational levels relative to other states?
So the share of California workers who have at least a bachelor's degree has been steadily ticking up. This is a good sign. This is a sign of progress. We have a better educated workforce than ever before. We have lost ground to other states. You know, other states have sort of outpaced California in education gains, and we still fare fairly well compared to the rest of the nation, but we are losing our competitive advantage.
And that, you know, possibly, you know, tuition rates have gone up in the last few years, that could play a role, but California's system is kind of unique in that if you look at around the country, more Californians use public higher education than in most other states. So they'll go to a community college or a CSU or a UC. So, you know, when those rates change, those tuition rates change, that has a big impact on Californians. Let me go to education and getting a good job. My parents always stressed, you know, get an education, you'll have a good life because you'll get a great job. Were they right? Is education the key to economic prosperity?
It is essential. It's not a guarantee of economic prosperity, but it's a key sort of ingredient for economic mobility. Right? College-educated workers get paid far more than other workers who have sort of similar qualifications, right? The same levels of experience, similar demographics, same age. If you're college educated, you're earning up to 70% more than that other worker.
And they call it the college wage premium.
Yeah, and it's flattened over the past decade, but it's still very high. And if you look at these issues of wage erosion and wage growth, all these problems that are affecting low and mid-wage workers, that's actually not happening over the long term for college-educated workers.
So get a college degree.
It's probably
a good idea.
Yeah.
What about the flip side of that equation, the growing share of low-wage workers in California? How common is low-wage work in our state?
About a quarter of workers in California are what we consider low-wage workers, and that is slightly above what it was 35 years ago. So college or low-wage work is actually a little bit more common than it used to be, and this is partly because we've let the minimum wage erode over time. It's less powerful than it used to be. It could be because of the type of industries, the rise of sort of the service sector and retail jobs. And so despite all these years of economic growth, we still have sort of this enduring low-wage work sector.
And we were talking earlier that the wage levels of low-wage workers has pretty much been flat over time. It's one of the problems maybe here are the power to negotiate higher wage increases.
Exactly. And the decline of unionization is playing a role here where workers across the board, low and mid-wage workers, have less bargaining power even during times that are good. And, you know, this recovery is pretty good. We have an above-average economic recovery. At the same time, low and mid-wage workers aren't seeing robust gains in their wages.
Okay. More work, not really more wages,
exactly.
I guess. A good summary.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the overview of demographics of the California workforce. So are state policies needed to help California workers? We'll get an employee perspective next. This is the Mattie Report. After the Great Depression, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt used government action to help build the middle class. 75 years later, do we need something similar to help California's struggling middle class? Our guest is Luke Reidenbach with the California Budget and Policy Center. One of the things you argue in terms of state policy, you're saying it's not kept up with the needs of the middle class, and one thing you talk about is the necessary increase in the minimum wage, that it hasn't stayed with the rate of inflation. There are some, though, on the business side that would say that if you raise the minimum wage, you're only going to encourage employers to hire fewer workers and or automate. How do you answer that?
So this is a widely cited concern about raising the minimum wage. This is often brought up. But recent history has proven that these fears are mostly unfounded. So that the combined evidence that we have on the impact of the minimum wage has shown little to no effect on the employment levels of low-wage workers. But that said, we should take these considerations seriously. I don't want to dismiss the concerns of the businesses. And so that's why I think when you implement minimum wage increases, you have to do it carefully. You know, you spread it out over a long period of time. You give them time to adjust. And so this isn't sort of one dramatic increase. I think you could be smart about minimum wage increases in a way that make it better for the business community.
Okay. So what about this thing called an earned income tax credit? You're hearing a lot about that now. Can you explain what it is and why you think it would help California workers and the state economy?
Sure. So California just passed what's called a state earned income tax credit. And this is based off of the federal earned income tax credit of the same name. And what it is it's essentially a tax credit for low-income working families. You have to be employed, but you also have low incomes. And you get a tax credit worth, for the California version, up to, or an average, around $500 to $800. And you get that in the form of a refund, or it reduces your tax liability if you have any tax liability. And the federal credit has actually been a huge success. Right, it gives families a really critical economic boost and a one-time check. It allows them to pay down debt, pay their bills, invest or save.
Right. Incentive to work because you have more money.
You have to work in order to get it.
And these people are going to—they're not going to typically save the money. They're going to spend it.
Some save, actually.
I would think that would heat up the economy, though.
Yes.
Because they're going to go out there and they're going to buy they're putting off buying that refrigerator or something.
Right. Yeah, and 80% of these checks are actually spent locally. So we're really excited about the earned income tax credit. Taxpayers will be able to claim it for the first time this tax year.
You know, the flip side of that coin is it's going to cost the state. They're going to lose some revenue if they give a tax credit. Where does the money come from to pay for this?
So the state earned income tax credit is projected to cost around $300 million. Our general fund budget is around $113 billion. And I think
it's $300 million cost on a budget of
$113 billion. Yeah.
Okay.
Put it in perspective. It's going to help a lot of people. And I think it really is about priorities, right? I mean, this is sort of a drop in the bucket, but also has the potential to huge impact on these low-income families.
You know, you've been working in and around state government and analyzing it too long. When you say $300 million, everybody does.
No,
it's a drop in the bucket.
As soon as I said that, I was like, it's not a drop in the bucket. But in terms
but
of
it is
what
compared
we're spending,
to the
we know we spent $10 billion on the state correction system, and so it really is about priorities.
One-thirtieth of that amount.
Yeah.
So another thing that you're talking about is education and skill levels. Everybody seems to say, listen, that's great because workers then can earn more money. But the devil, of course, is in the details. The question is, for example, with higher education, who's going to pay for it? Should the student be paying for it or should the state be paying more of that cost? What about skills improvement? Should that be the worker or should that be the employer? I mean, how do you answer those questions?
So this is a good question. I think on the issue of higher education, traditionally California has prioritized higher education so the public pays for it, right? It's an investment in California's workforce. So therefore, students pay a smaller share. They pay some of it, but they don't bear the brunt of the cost. Right. That has actually shifted, right? And tuition fees have more than tripled over the last 2 decades. And so I think it's less about who should pay for what. I think it's mostly a public investment, right? And because these things will, this will benefit our economy in the future.
You know, one of the things you talked about earlier was the overrepresentation of people of color in the criminal justice system and the impact that has on their ability to get a job because there are hiring restrictions and impediments. What kinds of restrictions and impediments are you concerned about and what would you like to see removed?
So there are a range of restrictions and challenges for people who are formerly incarcerated. One, they've seen their skills and education erode over time. So, one is just making them competitive in the workforce, right? And that includes, training for specific occupations or going back to school. They also actually face a number of restrictions on what kinds of jobs they can take. And some of these make sense, but some of them are a little goofy. And I think we need to sort of rethink about, limiting the kinds of jobs jobs that those who are in the system
take a closer examination of those things. One thing I want to just follow up on, we've only got about 20 seconds left in the segment, but I want to ask you about the role of unions in raising the wages of lower middle class workers. You know, the state can't deal with private sector workers. They can only deal with public sector workers in that regard. Federal law takes care of private sector workers. So one thing that the state could do is, for example, allow in-home health care workers to unionize. That would probably result in higher wages, but also result in higher costs. So isn't that just a wash? Is that really getting us ahead?
I don't think it's a wash, because some of these public employees are doing the kinds of jobs that I think we as Californians value highly, right? I mean, you know, we have the same approach to teachers, right? There's that same debate of teachers, of how much teachers should get paid. But at the end of the day, we value the work that they do, and we think that as long as unions are a way to increase that value of work for them, then it's worth doing.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for that perspective on state workforce policies. Up next, a business perspective on what needs to be done or not done by the state to help the middle class. That conversation in a moment. This is the Mattie Report. Unlike FDR, Ronald Reagan argued that trickle-down or supply-side economics would raise all boats and that government action would hurt, not help, the middle class. So what's the business perspective? Our guest is Tom Scott, Executive Director of the National Federation of Independent Business for California. So let's talk about minimum wage. You know, it's usually touted as a way to help the working poor, get them out of poverty. Proponents who want to raise it say inflation has eroded the earning power of the minimum wage. And they say that in any event, if you increase the minimum wage, research shows that it really doesn't have a big effect on employment. So what are your thoughts on raising the minimum wage?
Well, I mean, look, there's as much research on the other side that says that, you know, it has a huge impact, that it's, you know, it does not increase job growth. You know, small businesses have fixed budgets. Whether it's workers' comp, whether it's mortgages, all the capital costs, liquidity, inventory, you know, just the minimum wage increase that we've seen, you know, recently was about a 25% hit to small businesses. If we were to increase that to $13, let's say, I mean, that would be nearly a 63% increase on those fixed costs for a small business. I mean, I've seen some stats saying potentially a $13,000 hit per employee. So, I mean, there are definitely costs associated for the small business owner. I mean, if you have 10 employees, you're looking at potentially, you know, $130,000 that you're having to come up with.
And the question becomes, can you give those costs to the customer? Are they willing to pay for that additional expense? And some industries or some services and products, they don't. They won't. Some they will, I guess, so it kind of depends on the industry. What about earned income tax credit? That's another thing that people talk about, kind of helping the working poor. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, look, earned income tax credit, definitely, I mean, I know the statistics show that it raises people out of poverty. I think 3.3% of Californians have raised out of it with it. Mm-hmm. Should it be expanded? I know there's a huge percent that do the federal. I think 70% do the federal. There was a bill in the legislature this year, AB 43. NFIB didn't support it. We don't have a huge history in that area. I think if you were going to expand it, it should include small businesses.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, let me kind of switch gears a little bit and maybe talk about something you might agree with, maybe on the other side, and that is having a skilled workforce. It seems to benefit employers to have a skilled workforce and increasing need for college graduates, et cetera. So what's the state's role here? I mean, should they be putting more money into higher education, vocational training, or both?
Well, I mean, look, 55% of the state budget goes to education. I mean, that is a huge sum of money.
And that includes K-12 as well as higher education.
Plus higher. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there needs to maybe be more emphasis on the vocational training, whether it's construction, mechanical, all of those various jobs, good paying jobs. But this sort of obsession with the 4-year degree, you know, I don't know if it's paying off. It's paying off with large debt for students and not necessarily equaling jobs, but maybe more emphasis on the vocational training area.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be a big need there, and a lot of that training is actually done at the community college level.
Yeah.
So emphasizing maybe community college education.
No, definitely.
Another thing that was talked about in an earlier segment was ex-prisoners that served their time, and now they're out, but now they're having a hard time getting a job. Should we be doing things to make sure that people, once they pay their debts to society, can become productive members of society?
Look, I have been on a Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors. I serve on the Sheriff's Advisory Committee here in Sacramento County. I also chair the Folsom Prison Advisory Committee. I mean, this is one of these issues where, you know, when I toured Rio Consumnes Correctional Facility, I mean, the vast majority of the people that are there because they didn't have a job and they had to commit a crime. They have a son or a child, a wife. Look, we have to get these people back working. The business community has some responsibility in that. I don't think that means that, you know, there's a movement in this state to eliminate businesses' ability to check criminal backgrounds. I don't think that's the answer. But I definitely think, look, I mean, people have to be put back into work. I mean, they will not commit the crime again. So I think there is some fine line here. I've said repeatedly to the business community, you know, we have a responsibility here.
Finding that right balance. That's always that's always the question, isn't
it? That's huge.
Well, I want to thank Tom Scott with the NFIB for joining us, as well as Luke Riedenbach with the California Budget and Policy Office. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute by either looking at our website page or going on Twitter and following us there, or logging onto our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
Up next, one way up the economic ladder is to learn a trade. Most, however, come with licensing requirements. Are state licensing requirements a necessary protection for consumers or an unnecessary impediment to job mobility?
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
One out of every five Californians has to get a license to work in their chosen profession. And while licensing offers important protections for consumers, it can also create unnecessary barriers for those trying to enter those professions. Recently, California's nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission examined the costs and benefits of the state's occupational licensing requirements. We'll discuss their findings with our guest, Carol D'Alia, the executive director of the Little Hoover Commission. California's occupational licensing requirements: protection from harm or barrier to entry?
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Occupational licensing is intended to provide consumer protections, but at what cost? That was the question recently answered by a report issued by the state's nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission. Our guest is the executive director of that commission, Carol D'Alia. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thank you for having me again.
So lots of occupations require a license. Why?
Well, we'll go back to the very first license, one of the very first licenses required in the state of California, all the way back to 1876. It was the Medical Practice Act, and it dealt with doctors. It was the very first time.
Sounds like you'd want to have those licensed.
Yeah, so there were fraudsters running around preying on the
snake oil salesman or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So for the first time, we required doctors to have a license to show that they had some level of competency or education. And what was important then, consumer protection, then morphed into licenses for a lot of other reasons. So extending to other goals, such as professionalizing an occupation, creating standards, or perhaps a guarantee of quality. But at the same time, it also evolved into potentially a means of limiting the competition.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting. People would say that occupational licensing is a bit of an arcane topic. Why did you think it was important to do a study on this?
Well, it started with a 2015 White House report. And what the White House report found was 60 years ago, one in 20 professions required a license.
5%.
Yeah. Today in California, one out of five are required to get government permission before they can practice in the profession. Now, this affects millions of Californians. So it may be arcane, but it touches on all of us. So when there's a license and it raises prices, we pay more. If you are somebody who wants to join that profession and we've created these additional barriers, it affects people who are trying to be upwardly mobile in their careers.
So let me ask you this. So we got a lot of occupations that are licensed. I'm wondering, are the kind of the challenges of licensing requirements,
are they kind of specific to occupations, or there are some common issues that just licensing in general you got to deal with?
So we had this challenge of more than 250 licenses just under the Department of Consumer Affairs. That doesn't even include teachers, lawyers, insurance agents.
I hope you're
going
to say there are common challenges, because that's 250
yes.
individual
so we
problems.
Couldn't look at that level of right. detail. We flew at a higher level, and we did find some common things. So one is reciprocity with other states. So, for example, I'm an optometrist working in Chicago. I want to move my practice to Fresno. Well, maybe my license isn't going to be able to transfer here. And that was a common theme across many different licensing. Another challenge deals with folks who maybe have a prior conviction. We found that it was the same for many licenses. It was hard to figure out what would prevent you from getting a license and what wouldn't. The other same sort of thing, particularly in the professions where you earn lower income, was that you might invest a lot of time in training and the costs of the license, so they were expensive to have. So those were some of the common.
Creates a barrier, yeah. You also talk in your report about, quote, a jumble of licensing politics, unquote. What does that mean?
So 165 years of accumulated regulations creating this thicket of bureaucracy.
That is a great way to describe it, thicket of bureaucracy. It really paints a picture.
So you have these fairly autonomous boards who are under the umbrella of the Department of Consumer Affairs. But there is nobody in California to take this step back and have an holistic view of how we should license occupations. And at the heart of it, you mentioned politics. It's often a political activity. You don't see consumers banding together and going to the legislature and saying, we want you to regulate this profession. You see professionals or their associations coming to the legislature and saying, we want to be licensed. So it's more a political activity often than consumer protection.
Yeah, sometimes I teach law, and sometimes I have to explain to students how this works, the political process works. For example, maple syrup workers are exempt from overtime laws. And I ask the students, why do you think that is? Is it because of their job, or is it from some senator from Vermont who was very powerful at the time this law was passed and said, I need that exemption in the law? Politics plays a big role here. It's interesting in your report, you also mentioned a thing about nurses. Mm-hmm. There are multiple, whether you're a registered nurse or a licensed practical nurse, there's different organizations or bodies mm-hmm. that then certify you or license you.
It's a very that's another very confusing jumble. So you have, if you're a certified nursing assistant, it's under the Department of Public Health. If it's a licensed vocational nurse or a registered nurse, it's two different boards underneath the Department of Consumer Affairs.
So it's interesting. It's like all over the place. You'd
right.
think they'd all be under one roof, but apparently not. Well, up next, we're going to talk about some of the unintended consequences of occupational licensing. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Carol Dialia with the state's Little Hoover Commission about a recent commission report on occupational licensing in California. You know, you identified some unintended consequences of occupational licensing, particularly around the barriers to enter some of those occupations. What did you find?
Well, we found that particularly, again, for low-earning professions, not talking about doctors, dentists, lawyers, that it does create a significant barrier for people who might otherwise want to enter that profession. And it doesn't necessarily, as we talked about, provide additional consumer protection. So it limits entrepreneurship. We heard about, this was in a different state, but somebody who wanted to have a mobile barber shop, and that just wasn't possible. He had a need. People said they would be interested
in it. An entrepreneur, new concept, maybe he's going to make some money, drive so people don't have to go to his place, he can drive it around, and
couldn't do it. So it limits entrepreneurship. It makes it hard to relocate from another state to California. Mm-hmm. If you're a licensed professional, you have to think hard about, am I going to be able to have the job that I have here? We also got a sense that there were certain demographics, certain Californians, that were more negatively impacted than others. But unfortunately, the boards don't all gather demographic information, so it was more anecdotally we heard.
Yeah.
And so it was creating barriers for certain groups of Californians, and we're not even sure who they are.
Yeah, it was interesting in bringing your report that you were saying nationally, consumers pay an estimated $200 billion a year because of these licensing requirements, which is interesting. And it costs, you said, $300 in fees and 549 days of education, you know, to take on average in, to get licensed in some of these occupations. You know, critics are saying that occupational licensing does increase prices without actually increasing the quality of services. Are you finding that cost-benefit analysis, are you finding the same thing? Is it worth the cost?
So what we did was we brought in, as typical for Little Hoover Commission, we have public hearings, and we had some of the best national experts on this topic, and we relied on their research. And one study in particular showed that, depending upon the occupation, licensing increased prices by anywhere from 5 to 33%, so a significant cost increase. A specific item that they looked at was more lenient dentistry licensing policies and whether or not that had bad outcomes as far as in terms of people's experience, and they found it didn't. But they did find that the stricter licensing increased the cost, and then there were less dentists available. So at least in that example and others that we heard about, the additional licensing requirements weren't worth the added cost.
Yeah, the one I liked, I was reading your report, the one I liked was a study in Louisiana and Texas about licensed florists.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we have to license a florist? And did it really have any appreciable effect on consumer protection? Not really so much. It did increase prices to consumers, but it didn't really provide any additional protection, which I think is a great example of maybe some of the problems here. You know, there's a wide range, we were talking about earlier, wide range in occupations that are licensed. You know, I'm a lawyer, you know, take the bar exam. You've got doctors on the one end, maybe of the continuum, the other end. You know, you've got manicures and pest control workers, you know, wide range. Do all occupations that are licensed kind of get the same benefit from being licensed?
No. That's what we found. We found that the greatest benefit to licensing was to those in the higher income professions, those that you mentioned, the doctors, the dentists, the lawyers. But the effect on the wages is much lower for or less for lower income occupations, even when there's a lot of significant training and education involved, such as teachers and certain nurses and cosmetologists. So no, it wasn't the same.
Yeah, it seems like if you have these licensing requirements, say the bar exam, for example, that it increases wages because it decreases the supply. I remember when I took one of the bar exam that I took in Connecticut, there was a requirement to know insurance law. Now I never practiced insurance law. I had to study it, but, you know, it's a way to kind of keep people out. If you can't pass that section of the bar exam, it's fewer people that are lawyers that can charge higher rates.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the higher prices and barriers. There are got to be some legitimate benefits to this, too, right? I mean, there are some positive reasons why we already talked about. One is kind of consumer protection generally. Mm-hmm. But what are some of the positive reasons why we would want to have licensing?
Well, the most important, you've just mentioned, that's the health and safety. That's, and particularly when it comes to the healing arts professions, I think most people want to know that their doctor, or their nurse, their dentist has some level of training and some level of competency. It's some of the other areas where, just as you brought up with the floral designers, is that really, you know, if the floral arrangement is not as pleasing, am I going to be hurt as a consumer? No, I'm probably just not going to call that florist again. So, but some of the other benefits beyond the consumer protection is sometimes it will take a profession that has not been professionalized and give it a new added layer so that people look to this profession as a licensed professional. It can also stimulate standards for service and quality. So you would hope that because you're using a licensed professional, you have some guarantee.
It's standardized across the board.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm sorry. And there's also, you think when you report, you're talking about government guarantees of quality. If you have licensing, you're kind of given a guarantee. It's kind of like union carpenters or union electricians. If they go through an apprenticeship program, you know they're going to have a certain level of quality, you know. If they don't, you're not necessarily sure of that.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, we're going to talk about some of the groups, though, that are adversely affected by some of these licensing requirements, which you noted earlier. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with Carol Dialia, the Executive Director of the Little Hoover Commission, about a report they recently issued on occupational licensing in California. Now, you mentioned earlier that occupational licensing can adversely affect certain groups more than others. What groups?
There were several in particular. There are former offenders, There are veterans, there are military spouses, and then those folks trained in places outside of California, particularly those trained in foreign countries.
Yeah. So let's talk about each one of those. You know, you had some specific recommendations when it comes to active military and veterans and their families. It's military spouses as well. What's the occupational licensing problem there?
So I'll take them separately.
Okay.
If you're a veteran, you are potentially in a battle zone. Perhaps you are treating patients.
You could be a medic.
You are a medical tech. Mm-hmm. You have experience. You come back, and now you're exiting the military, and you want to continue. Well, it's really hard to translate that skill into becoming a registered nurse. And although there are some bright spots on the horizon where we're doing some good things on that, before I move on to that, the military spouses have the challenge of when a military family is relocated from one location to another, from one state to another, their license may not be accepted in the new location. So,
and there's a lot of moving around.
Yes.
So they call it, you know, military typically moving from station to station, and so if there's not reciprocity, there's a problem there.
Right, and if you're only there for a year or two, it's not worth the hassle and the expense of getting relicensed in each state that you move to.
And that has reverberations, I would assume, because the military spouse brings home income, and if they can't continue on in that occupation in a new state, let's say in California, that impacts whether or not the veteran or the military person wants to stay in the military, correct?
Yeah. We, in fact, heard from the Department of Defense, who said that was a national security issue because most of those who are married, it is a huge consideration whether or not their spouse can be employed.
You know, it's also interesting, too, we're talking about the medics, you know, in the military. We've already paid for their training, right?
Right.
In the military. Then, are you saying then we have to pay for that training yet a second time?
Yes.
So they can get their licensing.
Yes. So we're paying twice, essentially. And a veteran who's now, you know, they've served their time, they're coming out, and we're essentially saying, oh, well, that skill doesn't qualify. And it just, it seemed wrong on a lot of different levels.
But you have mentioned that states, including California, are moving to try to change those specific problems when it comes to
the
military.
Yeah. In fact, I give the legislature credit. They've enacted a flurry of laws, one in particular that relates to the medical technicians, that now requires, if you have a nursing program in California, that you develop a way for medical technicians to become a registered nurse. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be allowed to have a nursing program. So that was one law that really
that's
had big, some teeth.
That's a big hammer. Let's talk about foreign workers. Why is it important to break down the barriers for foreign workers?
So we're talking here about highly skilled professionals who are trained in other countries and come to California, perhaps they were a dentist or a doctor, and now have difficulty being able to practice the profession they were in. So here we have somebody who's a highly trained professional, competent in a different country, and yet they get here and they're unfortunately taking a lower paying job. We lose out because they're making less money, but we also lose out because in certain circumstances where we have workforce shortages, particularly in healthcare, here are people trained and culturally competent, fluid in different languages, that could be a boon to the California workforce.
You know, it's interesting. I had a neighbor who was from Latin America, a doctor,
mm-hmm.
and had a real problem getting certified, you know, in the United States, or licensed in the United States because of all the barriers that are involved. The last one I want to talk about was ex-cons. You're trying to get them to rehabilitate, reenter society if they, you know, finally straightened up their act. What are some of the recommendations you have for ex-cons to be able to get their licensing, to get into some of these occupations, become
sure.
contributing members of society?
Absolutely. So what we found as the barrier was, in a lot of ways, it's not clear. So somebody maybe had a conviction a long time ago, barely even remember what it was that they were charged with or convicted of. Maybe they pled out. They go to, they take coursework, they spend money and time, they're trying to get their life together, they pay their licensing fee, and they get denied. And they had no idea up front that what they had done in the past
was a
barrier.
These are not hardened criminals. These are people that may have done something stupid when they were young, and now it's haunting
yes.
them going forward.
And sometimes it's difficult to tell whether what their crime that they were convicted of is any relation to the current occupation that they're going to be doing. So it's finding a way to better sort that out. Our recommendation was really a easy one. Let's make it easily available to folks. So put it on the website. So if you're thinking about becoming a licensed professional in some particular area, you can go and see, okay, I have this in my past. I'm never going to be able to do this. Or, oh, there's some gray area. And the gray area we found to be acceptable because you don't want to, you may want to rule out somebody who has done something that would be significantly difficult for that person to be trusted in an occupation versus somebody who may have been charged with something, but the underlying cause was less harmful. And so we felt like we needed to keep some gray area, but that it needed to be more upfront. We also felt like there are certain boards that require the applicant to list their offenses. And in so doing, one of our witnesses said they fall into this candor trap where they put down what they think they've done, and then it doesn't match with the background check because it's been so long.
And it's an automatic reject.
Yes.
Now, some of these recommendations actually sound pretty simple. We're going to continue to talk about some of the recommendations on the report from the Little Hoover Commission in a moment. This is the Matty Report. Welcome. We're talking with Carol DiAlia, the executive director of the Little Hoover Commission, about a commission's recent commission report on occupational licensing in California. You noted in your report there have been no comprehensive attempts at reforming occupational licensing in more than a decade. It's a long time. Why do you think the commission's recent recommendations might succeed where past reform efforts really haven't?
Well, we decided to stay away from the big, broad, one-size-fits-all because you really can't reform licensing for a doctor, and then look at a manicurist in the same sort of vein.
Yeah, 250 of these licenses, that would take you some time.
Right. We also think the timing is right with the federal government being supportive of this, and it's a really bipartisan issue. We're having prices raised at the same time we're fencing people out of good jobs.
Yeah, it seems like everybody would agree to that. So two of your recommendations deal with data collection and a comprehensive license review. What are your recommendations and why are they necessary?
So as I mentioned earlier, the occupational licensing hits certain Californians more so than others. But we don't really know because we don't have demographic data. So our recommendation was have the boards, some of them are required, but have all of them collect and make available demographic data. So we at least have a starting point. What are the effects of the licensing? Who is affected? Is there a negative effect? We just don't know.
Older workers affected, younger workers affected, yeah, male, female, et cetera. You don't have that data right now.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so and you also recommended changes in what's called the sunrise review process. Mm-hmm. That's the decision of whether or not we even have licensing. And also the sunset review process, and that is, do we keep the licensing that we currently have? What were your recommendations in those regards?
So the sunrise process is used a little bit less because that takes a licensed group or somebody who wants to be licensed coming to say this is why we should be licensed. And that hasn't been very successful, at least under the current administration. The sunset process, every 4 years, every board under the Department of Consumer Affairs comes up for review. And they provide the staff with, here's our data, here's the information. Again, you don't see consumers at those hearings. You see the board, you see the licensed professionals and their associations. And it's an arduous process. It's difficult.
So that you'd like to see more of that done then, a little more detailed staffing, I think, is also an issue in terms of those review processes. We talked earlier about reciprocity, and that is, between states, for licensing. What are your recommendations in that regard?
Well, we made a pretty bold recommendation that reciprocity become the default. Now, a lot of California boards...
So it's the reverse. And
yes.
So what you're saying is you start off with assuming it's okay, as opposed to assuming it's not okay.
Right. And then you make the boards, in their normal process, in their sunset review, say, this is why California is different. This is why we need additional requirements to practice this profession in our state versus any other state. We also talked about a hybrid where maybe there's 5 states, 10 states that are very similar to California. Well, say, okay, if you're from New York, Florida, whatever state, you can practice in California so that we're not sinking to perhaps what is the lowest common denominator out there.
Yeah, that seems to make sense. We talked earlier about staffing. What's exactly the issue with staffing?
It just was, again, going back to the Sunset Review process, where they're faced with information that comes from the board. They have to do a lot of these. They're the only committee that looks at these boards. One person even suggested maybe they should have to go through the full committee process, and that would have a lot of different hearings. Instead, it's kind of one quick hearing with a lot of information. We thought about, you know, should there be some side of outside information, but at the end of the day, the commissioners were feeling like the process works, they just need a little more staff.
Yeah. Sometimes a penny wise and pound foolish, yeah. Right? So things are happening. It's costing consumers a lot of money because they're not taking a serious look at, you know, what the issues are in terms of occupational licensing. So pay me now or pay me later, I guess, mm-hmm. is the question there. Let me ask you this, though. Last question on best practices. You know, this is an issue, I'm sure, that occurs in a lot of states. Did you look around and what other states are doing, or even within certain departments in California, what they might be doing is, what's working?
So we saw a couple of models, and we highlight them in the report. So teacher credentialing, you can come to California with a teaching license from somewhere else, and you can teach, but you have to, within 5 years, comply with certain things. But at least you can be working in your profession while you're complying. We also saw the apprenticeship model as a promising practice. We do that for a lot in the construction trades. Well, maybe we take that same model and use it for healthcare workers. So now healthcare workers are often required to get hands-on training, but they're not getting paid. So we noticed, we were brought to our attention a pilot within Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation in the Stockton Medical Facility, where they're having vocational nurses on a track to become registered nurses. They're getting hands-on training 20 hours a week at the facility, 20 hours in the classroom, but getting paid for it all. They win because they're moving into a higher paid class. We win as a state because it's a place where we have a shortage of people in that profession.
It seems like that's a win-win for everybody. Well, I want to thank Carol Dialli, the Executive Director of the Little Hoover Commission, for joining us.
As well as Tom Scott with the National Federation of Independent Business California, Luke Riedenbach with the California Budget and Policy Center for joining us.
If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed in the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.